everyone. Welcome to In Your Element from Tetramap, where our focus is on developing people and business the way nature intended. Our guests will be sharing their expertise on what it's like when you're working in your element and working in a great team where people value each other's differences. I'm Louise Duncan, your host, and look forward to sharing this with you in the coming weeks. Well, hello again, and welcome to our latest episode of the podcast. We're delighted that today's guest is Dr. Benjamin Hardy. And Ben is an organisational psychologist, best-selling author of a book called Willpower Doesn't Work. And from 2015 to 2018, he was the number one writer in the world on Medium.com, which is an amazing accomplishment. And Ben's blogs are read monthly by millions, and I'm one of them. So I know we're in for a fascinating conversation today. So I'd like to say welcome to the In Your Element podcast, and it's great to have you with us, Ben.
Thank you, Louise. It is my pleasure. I'm grateful to be with you, grateful to have this conversation.
Fantastic. Well, Ben has also written a new book, which we're going to chat more about today, and it's called Personality Isn't Permanent, and it debunks some of the pervasive myths of personality and the things generally known as personality tests. So we'll be talking a little bit more about that later, but just before we get started, Ben, let's find a bit more about you, if that's all right.
Yes, ma'am.
So Ben and his wife, Lauren, adopted three children from the foster system in February 2018. And then a month later, his wife got pregnant with twins, and they were born in December 2018. So I think in the space of 1 year, Ben had five children. And he lives,
pretty much.
He lives with his wife in Orlando in Florida. So that is an amazing story in itself. So congratulations, first of all, we should say that to you.
And well, thank you.
Yeah. So we decided this podcast is called In Your Element, and it aptly described the work that we do with nature, with teams, and the whole essence of feeling great about being uniquely you. And there's a lot of synergies between what we do and the book that we're going to be talking about, Ben. So it was a really great read, and I know that people are going to love it. So let's just kick off with a couple of questions. And so, Ben, when you are in your element, can I ask you what you're doing or thinking or feeling?
Absolutely. When I'm in my element, I'm definitely feeling inspired. I'm feeling clear. I'm feeling powerful. I'm feeling confident. I think confidence is a big key. And I just feel like things are moving forward. Things are working out. And I'm also obviously feeling a lot of gratitude. I think it all just comes together. And I really try to get into that space every morning. I try to live in that space as long as I can. And if I'm out of that element for long periods of time, I'm messed up in all other areas of my life. And so I really try to produce that experience,
yes,
First thing in the morning in my life.
Yes, and I know from your writings that you give some great recommendations around that, which we may chat over later, and you talk a lot about context and environment, and we'll come to some of those questions too. So you set the context for your environment to help you feel confident, experiencing gratitude, and then you can move forward with whatever you might be doing in that day. That's great. So you set those conditions for yourself. And our model uses nature as a metaphor, Ben. So I'd like to ask you to share something about nature that's important to you. And how do you see it relates to human nature?
I mean, I'm a big lover of nature. I grew up in Utah, in Salt Lake City, Utah. And I spent so much time up in the mountains, snowboarding, actually. Mm. And just connecting. I mean, you know, the Winter Olympics were in Salt Lake City in 2002. And I spent so much of my time in junior high and high school snowboarding. At this point now, you know, we live in Florida and it's very different climate, very like hot and, you know, beautiful. I mean, the sunsets here are just amazing. And there's palm trees and just, and so I often take my two twin girls, because our twin girls now at this point are 15 months old, and sometimes they get a little stir crazy at night. And so I've got to take them on walks. And so I'll often walk them in our neighborhood you know, in the stroller for like 20, 30 minutes, and it ends up being perfect for sunset. And I've got just the gorgeous palm trees, and I feel really inspired and also just at peace when I'm walking and just like connecting to the beautiful trees and to the sun, you know, and the clouds and the different colors. And I don't know. I mean, I think that that's the most relevant thing to me right now is just the beautiful nature. I mean, I was even thinking about it given the current pandemic, you know, like I was actually parked. I love driving my car and parking at different locations and just writing in my journal and looking out the window. And yesterday, actually, I was parked in a particular parking lot, and there was just gorgeous trees. You know, the weather here in Florida is so nice. And there was just beautiful trees and beautiful sky. And I was thinking, you know, the world right now is in total commotion, but it is absolutely a gorgeous day. I mean, it's just so pretty. And these trees are so gorgeous. And it completely just gave me a sense that everything is going to work out.
Yeah. So nature has a way of helping us find what we need at that moment in time, whatever that might be. And this opportunity of what's going on at the moment in the world is instilling a lot of fear into people. And I think it's a good recommendation. Hey, just go take a walk in nature. It will help you.
It's a huge help. I mean, it really does help.
Thanks, Ben. That's great. Well, let's go back to your book, which for me was a compelling read. And thank you for that. I loved it. And it talks about, let me just give you some of the background, where it says personality isn't permanent. It provides science-based strategies for reframing past memories, becoming the scribe of your identity narrative, upgrading your subconscious, and redesigning your environment. Science proves that you are going to change your life, so therefore you might as well be intentional about that change. And it has been described as a game changer and the best self-help book to help people provide a better future for themselves. And for me personally, it was peppered with gems and insights, stories that we can identify with, and just scientific facts, I suppose, to back up the strategies. And for me personally, one of the things that jumped out at me, one of my favorite sections, was about transforming your trauma, which I guess everybody has in different ways at different times. So if we can start with the context for the listeners, what catalyzed you, Ben, into the decision to write this book?
Mm-hmm. Interestingly, it hits right on what you're talking about right now. So I released Willpower Doesn't Work in March of 2018. So literally a month after we adopted our three kids. And later that year, kind of when the dust settled, I was reading a book. I was reading a book called The Body Keeps the Score. Not sure if you've heard of that one or read that one.
I haven't, no.
Yes, The Body Keeps the Score is a very big book right now in the US. It's a thick book. It's very academic. It's huge. It's meaty. And it's considered kind of the number one book on trauma at the moment. Very scientific. And I was going to that book because I was recommended it to a friend, because generally trauma is now becoming, you know, realized to be one of the core, you know, causes, you could say, of addiction. And I've spent a lot of time studying addiction. And so I wasn't really expecting to go down this pathway, but I was listening to The Body Keeps the Score and just blown away by it. And a few of the things that the author said, and his name is Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, but two of the things he said led me to realizing I needed to write a book about personality. And I had thought a little bit about personality, but I didn't. It's such a broader, bigger topic than what I typically write on that I would have been very intimidated to write the book. But basically what Bessel says in the book, and he's in the whole book, is based on such beautiful science. But the first thing he said is that trauma creates what he calls a frozen personality. And essentially what happens is that when you have a traumatic experience and you keep it unresolved, that your personality essentially stops developing, and you stop developing as an emotional being from that point. And you're emotionally, essentially, you're stuck in the trauma, which is why your personality freezes, and that personality is never really supposed to stop developing. And trauma really keeps you trapped in the past, and it really stunts your emotional growth, and it makes you very emotionally rigid and very black and white in your thinking. Trauma leads, you know, if unresolved, it's the opposite of psychological flexibility, and flexibility is really what's required for learning. And so that was fascinating to me. But then he said another thing, that really kind of shocked me. And he went into a bunch of the research about how trauma stunts, or in many ways completely obliterates, imagination. So like he went into a lot of research on, you know, people with extreme PTSD and right. about how they would go through psychological tests, and about how they, you know, various tests that are designed to kind of test people's imagination skills and mental flexibility. And he found that people who were really traumatized, they had no imagination skills whatsoever. They were just really black and white in their thinking, and they couldn't see different perspectives or angles. And obviously imagination is so key for goal setting and for living, you know, and for shaping a future. And so those two insights just really made me think, you know, okay, I probably need to do this. I mean, during my, you know, this will be my last thought, but during my PhD, I had heard over and over from my professors that personality tests, you know, like Myers and Briggs and those things, were fundamentally non-scientific. And throughout my PhD, I studied psychometrics, which is basically how tests are designed. And so there was a lot of things that led to this, but it was ultimately reading The Body Keeps the Score that really hit me. And I'm like, okay, I need to explain to people what personality is and where it comes from, because there's so many wrong perspectives in pop culture. And so that's really what led to it.
I think that's very true, very true. And people throw that word around, you know, in almost every sentence sometimes, but, you know, it is such a complex thing. So many things make up your personality that it is important for people to understand what personality actually is and how it's defined. And I think you're, you know, in the book, you talk about the some of the common myths about personality. And I'm wondering if you could just please help us to explain what are a few of those most common myths that people don't really or really could have a deeper understanding to help them understand what personality really is.
So personality is generally defined as your consistent, you know, attitudes and behaviors, essentially how you respond to situations.
Yeah.
And it's kind of how you consistently show up. And what, and I think that that's a fine definition, although I think that personality actually is so much bigger than that, but there's reasons why you show up consistently. You know, one of them being trauma, obviously. Yeah. others being your environment, et cetera. But what the common perspectives are, that it's not factors leading to your consistency, but it's the fact that your personality is innate. That's kind of a general view, is that your personality is innate, and that it's who you really are, and that you're consistent because that's just your core being, and that there's nothing really you can do about it. That's just who you are. And so because personality is viewed as innate and unchangeable for the most part, maybe you can make minor tweaks, but you're not going to be able to fundamentally change your personality. And again, these are just the common views. Because your personality is innate, it's unchangeable, and it's authentic. It's who you really are. Then what the goal is for people to do is to discover their personality. This is why personality tests are so popular, for one reason, but the idea is that your personality is something you must discover. You've got to discover your true self so that then you can build your life around your true personality. And if you don't do that, then you're going to have a life of disappointment, because you're going to be trying things that are ultimately against your core self or your true nature or whatnot. And so it really leads people to trying to figure out who they are so that then they can set goals based upon their personality.
I see.
And so the whole element of this perspective is that you have to figure out who you are. You've got to find yourself. And also that the past is the most primary aspect of who you are.
Yeah.
That the way to better understand yourself, aside from maybe taking personality tests or getting new experiences, is to look back to your past to figure out maybe who you were as a child or things like that. So the past is viewed as the key, or is kind of the driving force. These are kind of the core perspectives that lead people to viewing themselves certain ways. And from my perspective, they're not only incorrect scientifically, but they're also just incredibly limiting. And they lead you kind of in a passive mode where you are trying to figure out who you are. And I think it leads to very limiting and very non-flexible and non-imaginative approaches to life.
Yeah. So this is what is so fascinating about your book, because then it's saying, okay, once you understand that, then you can use these levers that you've described to help you move forward into saying that your personality, in inverted commas, is something that you can alter, you can choose, you can influence, and therefore that can help you propel forward into choosing the life that you want to have, right? So I think, am I right? Would that be an accurate summary of what your book is aiming at?
Yeah. I mean, what I'm saying, so one of the core, absolutely, by the way, yes. One of the core tenets of psychology is that the past is the greatest predictor of the future.
Yeah.
You know, I actually don't necessarily disagree with that, but I disagree with the reasoning. Reasoning is that that you can understand a person by looking at their past. And I think that that's semi-true, but it's not the whole story. I do believe that people are generally more predictable than they need to be, but there are reasons why they're predictable. And those are the four levers that you're talking about. There's reasons why we consistently show up the way we do. And it's not because we can't change. It's because there are factors in place that are keeping us stuck. And so those are the levers that I then go through and explain how they work.
Yeah, I think those are fantastic. I found them fascinating. And one of them was about past traumas that hadn't been reframed. And I think in there you referred to, and I could relate to it entirely, a situation where somebody had been told very early on they weren't very good at maths. And I think that was me personally. And I was reading that going, yes, that's me. And it was quite fascinating. So the trauma thing, even though I wouldn't have described it as a trauma, I think it is something that's still with me many years later. And that one was really important. And then the next one was about an identity based on the past, not on the future. And that one is key. So before we move on to the next one, perhaps you'd like to talk about this. We've talked about the trauma a little bit, but the math story was fascinating. Do you want to make a comment on that for the listener?
Yeah. So I can give a quick kind of definition to some degree, a loose definition of trauma. And we're talking about mostly in this case, emotional traumatic experiences. Trauma in this case is any negative experience or just it's really any experience that shapes how you view yourself in a limiting fashion. So in the case of math trauma, what the research, shows is that, an enormous amount or an enormous percentage of junior high and high school kids, have experienced math trauma. And what happens is this could happen in the form of being told you're not good at math or just failing a test or having a bad experience. And so you have a negative emotional experience, a negative emotional reaction to an event, and then that forms into what's called a cognitive commitment, like an emotional or mental commitment. And it's really a story, but it's a story that's identity forming. And really, so let's just say you're told you're not good at math. And then your feelings turn into a statement, which could be, I guess I'm not good at math. And so what that does then is going back to the idea of imagination, it stops you from further imagining yourself pursuing math. There's a really good quote from Robert Brault, and he said, "We're kept from our goals not by obstacles, but by a clear path to a lesser goal." And so the idea is that, whatever the negative experience was, it shaped how you view yourself, and it ultimately led you to pursuing something away from math. It led you to believe that you're not good at this thing, or that you can't get any better than you currently are. And so what they call this in psychology is a fixed mindset. And so essentially, you have some negative experience and it shapes how you view yourself. But that not only does that event shape how you experience yourself, but it shapes your future goals. And those goals are, would always be away from math. You wouldn't pursue math anymore. You'd pursue a more clear goal that you believe is something you could do, some other area where maybe you don't have a fixed mindset. And so that's really how trauma works. I mean, it doesn't have to be about math. I mean, you could have any negative experience. I mean, and obviously there's some really bad ones, such as maybe sexual abuse or other things like that. So anyways, if you have, we all go through hard experiences in our life. And the point here is that if those experiences aren't healthily framed or contextualized or viewed from a mature perspective or encouraged, as an example, the person who fails a math test, if they were encouraged or supported through that, they would likely be able to get through that experience and then continue learning rather than stopping their learning and development. For example, we have
you know, our two twins now are 15 months old, and they're actually doing swimming lessons because we have a swimming pool at our house, like many people in Florida do. And the last thing you want is your little baby to fall into the swimming pool. And so our little twins who can't even talk are going through swimming lessons right now. And like, it's amazing to watch because one of them actually kind of likes it, but the other one truly is tortured by the experience. You know, because the woman who's basically training them, like puts them underwater and is training them how to like flip onto their back and float. And it's amazing that like these girls would not do this if they weren't forced to, like, but they're learning against, you know, so the first experience, you know, like the first experience going underwater and like feeling helpless, like would easily be a trauma. But the person teaching them like will hold them, nourish them, you know, like pat their back, hug them, and then do it again and do it again and again and again. And essentially this person is helping them develop confidence and ability. And in the case of math trauma, there's none of that there. Like someone has a bad experience, but there's no one to walk them through it. And so that's why Peter Levine, he wrote the book Waking the Tiger, Healing Trauma. He said, trauma isn't what happens to you. It's what you hold inside in the absence of an empathetic witness, you know, in the absence of someone there to support you and encourage you through it. Like if you know anyone who's become great at something, they had to get a lot of encouragement through the ups and downs.
Yeah, absolutely. And we don't, but I think this is very true, Ben, because, you know, reading the thing about maths and it related to me and then linking it to fixed mindset and Carol Dweck's work and all the rest of it, it really does start to help you understand these self-limiting things that you've maybe grown up with or that are around you. And it's really important learning for us. And you've got five children, mine are grown up now, but you know, it's that kind of way of maybe we have imposed some of that on our children and we haven't helped them to become the real best person that they can be because of our own fixed mindset around things. So I really loved her work too. And I think, you know, that's really helpful understanding. So I would say for anybody listening to you or, you know, wanting to help understand how we can get past these things, it's a really good read. Both Carol's book and yours, really nicely complementary to one another. And perhaps if we could think about another question that I would like to get to is really this thing about the environment, because you talked to it when we started chatting today about the environment supporting their current and, you know, supporting your future identity. So things like that, I think, can really help people on a practical basis to actually step forward. And in the book, it talks about a very, very good way to systematically design and become the future desired self, which means that people don't have to be stuck in the past. So I just wondered if I could get you just to talk a little bit about what that process is and how it helps people move past the being stuck situation.
Absolutely. It's important so one of the big aspects, so research shows that the role you're currently in a large way predicts your personality. So like we all go through different roles in life, you know, like right now, a big part of my role is being a father of young kids, you know, and like that changes how I live and respond and what I do versus like me without kids. If I didn't have kids, I'd probably be doing something different. You know, like, I mean, there'd be similar things that I would do, but this kind of shifts my role and my attitude. And so your role in large measure shapes how you show up and obviously your context, you know, context is so key. Context really determines the meaning of the content. And this is one of the things that personality tests ignore.
Can you say that again? That was great. What you just said.
Yeah. So context determines the meaning of the content. And, you know, the problem is that, you know, especially when you have a fixed mindset, you overly focus on content and you ignore context. And, you know, environment really is all about context and about shaping the context to ultimately facilitate who you want to be. A big problem with personality tests is that they ignore context. You know, you get a score on a test and you assume that that score is always you. You know, you get a label and you assume that it's always true in every context, which is not true.
It's definitely not true.
No, and in some situations you're gonna be one way, and some situations you're gonna be another.
Totally.
And so, you know, that's a big downfall. I mean, and even the research shows it. Like there was a one research study that, you know, showed that if you took a personality test in one condition and you took the same personality test in a different condition, you'd actually get two different scores. And so, you know, the environment you're in actually determines how you view yourself and in the mood and the situation you're in. And so anyways, going to the idea of designing your context or designing your situation. Well, actually, if you don't mind, I would love to share one story that's not in the book that kind of fully emphasizes this point, and then I would explain how to systematically Well, good. Well, I just really want people to understand this idea of context and its importance. And so I'll tell a story of my mother-in-law. This is a recent story. And she actually was in the gym, exercise gym not too long ago, and she was exercising. And there was a woman in the gym exercising, and this woman happened to be very overweight, very much so, like obese. And this woman was wearing very tight fitted exercise clothing. And it was a little awkward for, I think, a lot of the people in the gym. And my mother-in-law happened to be working out next to this woman. And again, she was wearing very tightly fitting, like very, visual exercise clothing. But my mother-in-law started talking to this woman, and she quickly found out that in the past 6 or so months, this woman had actually lost 150 pounds.
Wow.
And so do you think that in learning that information, my mother-in-law's perspective of this woman changed at all?
I'm sure.
It did. Why do you think it would, just off the cuff?
Yeah, well, because you'd be reframing, going, well, she's really overweight, to isn't she a hero having done that and having the confidence to get dressed up and keep coming to the gym and celebrating the fact that, yes, she might still be overweight, but now she can buy exercise clothing, for example. She probably couldn't at 150 pounds heavier.
What you said is exactly what my mother-in-law said. I mean, she went in, you know, my mother-in-law is not a critical person, but, you know, she said admittedly that maybe she was a little judgmental, but she said as soon as she had found that out, she went from maybe being a little critical to being completely inspired.
Yeah.
Just shockingly so.
Totally.
And so this is the idea that, you know, the woman didn't change. Like she was still the woman, the content didn't change, the context did. And people who didn't have my mother-in-law's context would incorrectly, or, you know, they would be limited in how they viewed this woman.
Totally.
And with an expanded view of context, all of a sudden what you're looking at is totally different. So Wayne Dyer, he said, when you change the way you see things, the things you see change.
Totally.
And so the thing context really matters more than content as a key. But context is not just your view of things. It's also literally what's around you. You know, your content. So like there's a lot of research that talks about how your peer group, as one example, heavily predicts almost all the outcomes of your life. Like, you know, your social group predicts, you know, your income level. It predicts your likelihood of becoming an alcoholic. It predicts, you know, your likelihood of being successful in school or going to graduate school or becoming a criminal. Like all of these things are predicted by peer group.
Yes.
So it's really crucial to understand that the environment you're in is shaping you more than you know, and that you're not just some floating, you know, entity, but that you're shaped by your context, your environment. And so, you know, when you really begin to conceptualize or begin living intentionally, which means to really think about who you want to become and to own that fully, to think in terms of like, who would you truly like to be if you didn't have a fixed mindset? Like if you weren't afraid to pursue what you wanted, or if you weren't worried about what people thought, but if you were genuine and honest about who you wanted to be, you would really need to define that person and think about who they are and what they're like. And that begins to form your future identity. It also should form your story, but, you know, yeah, go ahead. I was going to go to environment from there, but go ahead.
I was going to say that there was a question from your book, which I've highlighted, which links to that.
Oh, let's hear it.
And it was, what types of freedoms, choices, circumstances, experience, and daily behaviors does your future self engage in? And that to me was such a powerful catalytic question that I just would love everybody to hear it, write it down, and answer it for themselves.
I love that. I'm so grateful. Yeah. And so the idea is once you've actually defined this person, which it's super crucial that you do, and it's not assumed that this is going to stay the same. Actually, the research shows that your future self is going to be different than your, you know, just like you're not the same person you were 10 years ago. Your future self is going to be different than who you are now. They're going to have different goals. They're going to have different perspectives. But it's still important to conceptualize and think about who your future self is. And the more defined you can get, the more intentional you can live today. And if you're living intentionally, then by nature, you're not living, if you're living consciously and intentionally, then you're not living subconsciously. You're moving forward. You know, your subconscious is holding you at your current level. And usually your subconscious is really triggered by your environment. And so if you look at your environment and if you think about who you currently are, and if you want to become someone new, if you want to become someone maybe that you really would like to be, or someone with, you know, more freedom or better in a different situation, and maybe even has different attributes or has different relationships, then it's really important that you begin thinking about, you know, the environment that's keeping you where you're at. And it's more powerful than to begin shaping an environment that would help you become the person you want to be. That would include the information that comes in. So there's an important quote from Zig Ziglar, and he said, your input shapes your outlook and your outlook shapes your output. And so thinking in terms of input, this could be the information you're consuming, you know, the experiences you're having, the people you're around, the food you're eating, all of this stuff is coming from the outside world in. Mm-hmm. And the stuff that comes in shapes you. And so I kind of lay out a few simple principles as far as how to be thoughtful about this. One being, you know, ignorance, you know, strategically ignoring or strategically removing inputs that are clearly keeping you stuck, you know, like blocking yourself from, you know, we were just talking about even the news, you know, obviously it's good to be informed, but at a certain point, the information coming in may just totally block you from being in your element, you know what I mean? And block you from being inspired. And
totally
kind of
paralyzing.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it really is. And so at some point you need to just shut it out so that you can actually focus on where you want to focus. And so you, rather than fighting against your environment and trying to stay in your element while also consuming information or experiences or people that are, you know, basically paralyzing you, it's better to just eliminate the noise. And so you want to be ignorant of the things, strategically ignorant of the things that are ultimately distractions. And that what that requires is ultimately that you make wise decisions. Just as an example, knowing, for example, that scrolling through Facebook for a few hours or even for just an hour or less, knowing what you're going to get yourself into if you go do that, you know. And I'm not telling you you don't have to do that. I'm just telling you. It's being aware of the opportunity cost of doing so and saying, do I really need that in my life? Do I really need to put that into my brain?
Yeah. I can relate to that, because that's being very passive about that, isn't it? And setting yourself a limit. So I've set myself, going back to Facebook, I've set myself a limit of 10 minutes on Facebook, and then that's it for the day. And then that I go off, because I love Facebook. It allows me to keep up with my friends and family.
Oh, yeah,
I don't want to go into all the other scenarios. But I think that's really helpful to people.
Well, you can get sucked in, right?
I can
go into that
environment.
We all do. You can get into that environment. It's literally been designed to suck you in. It's like a casino in Las Vegas. And so it's like, you know, what BJ Fogg, and he's a Stanford, you know, psychologist, and he's actually the teacher who taught the kids who made Instagram, but he said that design beats willpower. And these things have been designed to literally addict you. And so you go in and you had the intention to be on for 5 minutes, but if you're not thoughtful or don't have these rules like you have, that environment can lead you down a path you didn't think you were going. And that's really where you're living subconsciously and not intentionally.
Well, thank you, Ben. I mean, we could go on forever and ever, because it's such a fascinating conversation, and I knew it would be. But I wanted to say that, you know, for me personally, and I know for our listeners, they are going to really enjoy the content of this book. And I can't, you know, first of all, I'd like to say that thank you for the structure of it with the stories and the science, because that helps people chunk it down quite nicely. Here's an interesting story. Now, here's the facts to back it up. And then the process that you've given, here's what you could do about it to help people move past the things that they don't even realize they're doing and then set them up for this future self that they want to be. And I think it's an excellent read. So I'm going to start to, you know, wrap it up there, because I think we've talked for long enough for such interesting topics, and we could talk for another 2 hours, but I want people to go themselves and buy the book. And so I'm just going to ask you one final question. The book is peppered with beautiful quotes. Is there one that you'd like to leave us with that is something that you tend to have as a rule for your life, or something as an intention that you live your life by?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's so many.
There's so many in the book even.
Yeah. No, there are. There are lots in the book. And I think that I'll just give one, even though I want to give five. But, the one that I really love a lot is, it comes from Clayton Christensen. He's the Harvard business professor who sadly died earlier this year.
Oh.
But he was so brilliant, so influential. But one of the things he said is, 100% is easier than 98%. And basically what he was talking about was it's easier to be 100% committed to something than it is to be 98% committed to something. And when he said that, and I read it for the first time a couple of years ago, I really loved it just because I kind of intuitively got it. But then in further studying psychology, I really got it. And I'll just break it down just a little bit and I actually have a big image on my wall talking about designing environments so that my kids can see this. And it says 100% is easier than 98%. But let me just explain it really briefly so that your listeners can understand this, because it's really pivotal actually. So let's just imagine that you're 98% committed to a certain diet. You're going to do this thing 98%. The problem with that is that in every future situation you're in, you have to ask yourself, is this one of those situations where I'm going to live the diet or not live it? And what that creates is what we call decision fatigue. And so if you haven't made a decision, but you're only semi-decided, or you're not even fully decided, then in every future scenario you're in, you've got to make a choice. You know, do I eat the dessert in this situation or do I not? If you were 100% committed to a specific diet, then you wouldn't even have to go through that mental tug of war. But because you are only 98, then in every future situation, you've got to make a choice. And it really burns out your willpower to have to make decisions like that. It's a lot easier mentally and emotionally and for motivation to know what you're going to do. and what the research shows, and speaking of context, is that usually the situation wins. So if you haven't decided what you want, then, and I think we can all relate, often maybe, you're in a situation where like the dessert just looks too good. Even if you're trying to be on a diet, and you're going to say, well, I'll just eat it this time, but you say that a million times. and so the idea is that if you're not making a decision, then you're going to have to deal with decision fatigue. And decision fatigue really... What that means is that you're not living with intention. And what it means is that you're far too often the product of the situation. And so it's a lot more powerful to simply make a decision, because then you don't have to deal with that decision fatigue anymore. You can be in situations and you can have confidence and you don't have to go back and forth, but you can move forward. And so that's been a crucial understanding for me, because it allows me, just as an example, to set one intention. Let's just say when I'm going to bed for the morning, I can wake up and I can know what I'm going to do. And if you don't know what you're going to do when you're waking up, then it's really easy to hit the snooze button, because you've put yourself in a situation where you've got to make a decision first thing in the morning about what you're going to do. And that's a bad situation to make a decision. It's a lot easier if you've made the decision the night before, so that when you wake up, you already know what you're going to do. So you don't have to make a choice and you don't have to rely on decision fatigue. And in such situations, you don't have to fail to the environment.
Thank you, Ben. I mean, that's just a brilliant suggestion to leave everybody with. And it really makes sense to people, because it's one of the key things that will help you move forward. You've decided this. Yeah. You don't have to decide it again. That's the whole thing. You've decided this. You don't have to decide it again. It doesn't mean you can't change your decision, but until you change your decision, you haven't got to make that decision again, which I think is very easy for people, because we are in overwhelm with information and do we do this and do we do that or do we do the other. So setting a clear decision and then not having to decide again enables you to initiate more things, do more things that you want to do because you've made that decision already. That's what that means to me. It's a great quote and thank you for resharing it. Lovely.
Yeah, no, you're welcome. And honestly, there's obviously a lot behind how to make a decision and how to get really committed to
it. I realize that.
And the book breaks that down as far as the identity and the environment, but it really helps mentally and emotionally to get committed to things and to build that confidence and to watch yourself be who you want to be rather than always kind of being on the fence and not being clear on your identity.
Mm. Yes. And I know the book talks a lot about confidence too. And that's another whole topic for another day, but thank you, Ben. I think it's great. And what I'd like to ask you is there anything else you'd like to say just as a wrap-up comment for people? Obviously, I want people to go out and get the book because I know the value of it, but anything else you'd like to wrap up with?
No, I would just encourage readers if they're wanting a really deep, but I would say, you know, comprehensible, easy to understand book, but very deep, I think that this book would really open you up to helping you understand why you've been the way you've been and why your life's been the way it's been. And I think it would really help you understand where you can make desired changes in your life and maybe even big radical changes if you wanted, but even small changes and help you to better understand or re-understand former experiences that have been really impactful to you and maybe helping you see those from a different perspective and becoming the narrator. And yeah, so I would just encourage people to read this book. I think it will really, really help you. And I'm just grateful that I got to be on your show and have such a beautiful conversation.
Well, I'm so grateful for you to joining us because as I said right at the beginning, I've been reading your blogs for some time. And as soon as I saw you'd written a book, I thought, wow, I wonder if he would be a guest on our podcast. And today, here we are having that conversation. So that's about setting your intention. And I'm grateful for you, Ben. So where can people get the book from?
They can get it pretty much anywhere on the internet. You know, if you buy, you know, Audible, or if you'd prefer Amazon or Barnes and Noble or local bookstores, you know, like you can pretty much get the book anywhere. You can learn more about it at benjaminhardy.com, my website. You know, there are some free bonuses and giveaways if you buy the book, that, you know, free online courses and things like that. So,
oh, wow.
You know, but would be grateful, you know, to people who are fascinated in the book and who want to educate themselves to get it. And you can kind of get it anywhere and you can learn more about it at benjaminhardy.com, but you can get the book anywhere.
Thanks, Benjamin. Well, what a fascinating conversation. Thank you for joining us this afternoon, this evening, this morning, whatever time of day it is for our listeners, wherever they are in the world, because they're all over the world. And I wish you every success with the new book, and we look forward to hearing more from you in the future. Thanks again for joining us, Ben.
Thank you, Louise. You're beautiful, and it's been a pleasure.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thanks, Ben.